Thank you, Mike. Okay. I can tell this thing's on already. This is really bad. Okay. Good morning. Hope and pray you're all doing well. I had 10 student interns this summer. Some of the most awesome young people you can possibly imagine, right? They run me ragged every year. I told them the story of Wilbur and Orville Wright. In case you don't know Wilbur and Orville, their father was a bishop in the United Church of Christ in the Midwest, northern Midwest area, Ohio River Valley. And their dad traveled from church to church to church. And he was very rarely home. But the boys had a very religious upbringing, and both of them knew who Jesus Christ was. They never, ever flew their airplanes on Sunday. It didn't matter where they were. It didn't matter what the circumstances were. They never flew on Sunday. There's a story about how in late 1902, they knew that they had solved the problem of the airplane. They had all the pieces, and they were in the process of trying to figure out how to build the very first airplane. And they're doing the sewing, and they're buying the lumber, and they're doing this while running their own bicycle shop and having to earn income so that they can continue to feed their family and eat. And there's this day where they're laying everything out, and they're talking about how they're going to mechanize what they're doing. And Wilbur has to stop for a minute, and he turns to his brother Orville, and he says, "Is it not amazing that God has hidden all these secrets for all these years just for us to discover?" And at that point, it plays out, and the very next time they go to Kitty Hawk, they fly their airplane for the very first time. And this is the day that we, as aero engineers, and particularly in this valley, all celebrate, right? So here's the object lesson from this. Doesn't like me. Okay. The lesson here is that life is a journey. That's a process you have to go through. And my 10 students, by the way, 7 of them were Christians. That was not intentional. That just happened. By the way, it was a 50-50 split between the guys and the girls. And there were a couple of times where it was all the guys working on one thing and all the girls working on something else. I didn't set it up that way. I didn't make assignments. You know, they sorted out on their own, figure out where they're going, what they're going to do. And all of them understood what we were doing while we were doing this. We're uncovering the secrets that God has hidden, and that we're thinking God's thoughts after Him. Now, the stuff that we do is incredibly crude by comparison to what He does every day, and certainly according to His plan. But it's His design. When it came time for them to leave, deep down I knew this would be my last set of students. And I was trying really hard to be brave as their departure came closer. And I almost held it together. There was this one kid who came up to me with tears welling up in her eyes, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. Life is a journey. It was time to send them back to their real families, to their real schools, to their real lives. We often get reminded of this, that God's plan of salvation was a journey as well. That there were a lot of things that had to happen all along the way. Michael told us about the dedication of the temple, Solomon's temple, last week. Really, really good passage. And the funny thing was, I wanted to talk a little bit about the dedication of the temple because it's a really important one. So this journey is sort of a message as well, and it draws a thread all the way through the Old Testament, all the way into the New Testament. And eventually we're going to get to an end point. There is a destination. It's going to take me a little while to get you there, so you'll have to bear with me for a minute. This is a topical style of message. And we're going to pick up there where Michael left off and end up and get to the topic of who is Jesus. We're going to start in 1 Kings 8 again, just a few verses earlier than where Michael was. So let me dig this out. We're going to go verses 9 through 11. And what happens here happens just before Solomon prays the dedication of the temple. Okay? So this is 1 Kings 8, 9 through 11. Nothing was in the ark, only the two tablets of stone which Moses had left there in Horeb when Yahweh cut a covenant with the sons of Israel when they went out of the land of Egypt. And it was when the priests went out from the holy place that the cloud filled the house of Yahweh. And the priests were not able to stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Yahweh had filled the house of Yahweh. Now I want you to stop and imagine what that must have been like. All the elders of Israel are assembled, and they're looking up at the Temple Mount. And the cloud comes down and inhabits the temple. And I can only imagine the light streaming out through the colonnades. And the priests can't stay in the temple. They flee before what they're seeing. The whitest of light, brighter than the sun itself, streaming out. Can you imagine that? We had that line in that song this morning. Here in your presence, heaven and earth become one. I imagine I know what this would look like, right? But it's wrong in my brain. I know it. I know I can't imagine something that amazing. This was the first temple. It was built by Solomon. Hiram of Tyre helped. The king of Tyre had helped. This happened in about 957 BC, almost 1,000 years before Jesus comes. And the first temple was built to establish the site of the annual sacrifice for the Passover. And this was done for the forgiveness of sins. Okay? Now they've been conducting the sacrifice in this place for a while at this time. But this was being done at the temple now. And that's why the place was built. So I want you to think of it. Every year, the crowds would come on their pilgrimage. And every year, the new young children would ask their parents, "Why does an innocent lamb have to die?" And the parents would reply every year, "We do not understand, but an innocent lamb must die to atone for our sins." And every year, the children would ask. And every year the parents would say, "I don't know. I don't understand. We're just told we have to do this." That temple would stand until 586 BC. And the Babylonians would overthrow Judea, and Solomon's temple would be destroyed along with the city of Jerusalem. And all the people are carted off into exile. And all of this happened because the Israelites and then the Jews had forsaken God. And because of this, God left them. Let's open our Bibles now to Ezekiel 10. Ezekiel 10, 18 to 22. Verse 18. "And the glory of Yahweh went from upon the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubim. And the cherubim lifted their wings and rose from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels were also with them. And he stood at the door of the eastern gate of Yahweh's house. And the glory of God of Israel above over them. This is the living creature that I saw under the God of Israel by the river Chebar. And I knew they were cherubim. Four, even four faces to each, and four wings to each. And the form of a hand's man was under their wings, and the form of their faces, they are the faces I saw beside the river Chebar, even their appearances, each straight. So this is a really, Ezekiel is really difficult to understand. He has all these visions, and he's trying to explain what he's seeing, and he doesn't have the language to express it in a way that we can understand. So we get these pieces, okay? And I'm going to tell you about some of the crazy theories that go along with this, all right? Don't believe them, please. At least the ones I'm about to tell you. There are people who believe that the wheels are flying saucers, okay? And I have to say, God does many wonderful and amazing things we can't even begin to understand. Just accept that this is a mystery, and we don't understand it yet. But this is the image that Ezekiel has of God leaving the temple. And he forsakes the people of Israel because of this. Jerusalem and the temple are destroyed. It's a short span of years, and the Jews return from their exile, and they begin to rebuild again in 539 BC. The temple is rededicated in 515 BC when it's completed. So it didn't exist for about 50 years, 52 years. There were young children who were marched off to exile that came back as people, grandparents perhaps, to see the temple rebuilt. And perhaps some of them would have to help out to try and figure out how to put the temple back together again. And it again would be renovated and expanded to be completed once more in 20 BC. And then that time it would stand in that form for almost 90 years. So did you ever stop to think why the temple had to be rebuilt? The temple existed for the sacrifice. And the temple had to be rebuilt because God's perfect sacrifice had not yet been made. And this is why the temple had to be there. Ezekiel has another vision, a prophecy. So let's flip over to Ezekiel 43. We're going to look at verses 1 through 4. I told you this is going to be jumping around all the way through the Old Testament and into the New. Ezekiel 43, 1 through 4. Verse 1. And he led me to the gate that faces the way of the east. And behold, the glory of God of Israel came from the way of the east. And his voice, like the voice of many waters. And the earth shone from his glory. And as the appearance, the vision which I saw, as the appearance when I came to destroy the city, and the appearances as the appearance that I saw by the river Chebar. And I fell on my face, and the glory of Yahweh came into the house by the way of the gate, which faced in the way of the east. So this particular vision Ezekiel never gets to see, but he writes it down and he gives it to us. Now there's some debate about whether this is to us, whether this has already happened, or if this is another vision that is something yet to come. We truly don't know which it is, but I suspect it's referring to something that's already happened. And I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. God returns to the temple by the same gate by which he left, through the east gate. All right. So now I want to jump into the New Testament. Let's go to Matthew 21. Matthew 21, 1 through 11. Let's see how badly I can butcher it out of this. Matthew 21, 1 through 11. Here we go. And when they drew near to Jerusalem, came to Bethphage, toward the Mount of Olives. And Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go into the village opposite you, and immediately you will find a colt, and with her a young colt. Loosen and lead them to me. And if anyone says anything to you, you shall say, 'The Lord has need of them,' and he will send them at once." But all this happened that it might be fulfilled by which was spoken by the prophet, saying, "Tell the daughter of Zion, behold, your king comes to you, meek and mounted on a donkey," even a colt, "the son of a donkey." And the disciples, going and doing as Jesus ordered them, they led the donkey and the colt. And they put on them their garments, and he sat on them. And most of the crowd spread their garments on the road, and others were cutting branches from the trees and were spreading them in the road. And the crowd, the ones going before and the ones following, were crying out, saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he coming in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." And as he entered into Jerusalem, all the city was shaken, saying, "Who is this?" And the crowd said, "This is Jesus, the prophet, the one from Nazareth of Galilee." So there's something I need to explain to you about this particular passage. It turns out that this little tiny village, Bethphage, is on the east side of Jerusalem. So as he's riding up to Jerusalem, he enters the city through the east gate. One of the apostles that is with Jesus following along is John. John sees all this. All the apostles are filing in through the east gate as well, following Jesus. There's a funny thing that happens to the east gate. The Romans destroy the city in 70 AD. The east gate is buried. It was discovered in an archaeological dig in 1969. And that's, the east gate is underground. It's under the dirt on the east side of the Temple Mount. There's a new east gate that was built upon that site. And that is the current east gate to the Temple Mount. The current east gate, fascinatingly enough, is walled up. It's filled with bricks and mortar. This was done by a certain sultan, Suleiman the Magnificent, in about 1541. And the reason it got bricked up, because Suleiman knew this passage, and to prevent God from entering through the east gate, the Christian God from entering through the east gate, he would brick the thing up. Now, I think there's perhaps a misunderstanding on his part about who God is, because bricks ain't going to stop Jesus. I mean, they're just going to fall down. All he has to do is say the word, and bricks are just going to fall down. He's going to walk right through. So I think there's a misunderstanding about whether the gate is there or not. And if Jesus isn't God, then it doesn't matter. He can come and go through the east gate, and it doesn't matter. I find this pretty comical, actually. I mentioned that John was one of the apostles that came in through that east gate. John was a very, very young man, perhaps 14, 15, 16 years old. This was not uncommon for rabbis that were traveling in the Middle East at that time, that there would be these young students following the older rabbis around. And John is following along with his older brother, and apparently John's family had some measure of wealth. They weren't super rich, but they had a comfortable life. Their dad had a fishing boat in Galilee, and they worked on the fishing boat with their dad and several servants as well. They were, however, relatively uncultured, somewhat illiterate. The ability to read probably was beyond all of them. So when we read this, and we read John, you have to keep this in mind when you're reading John. And the other thing that's amazing about John is when he writes all this, he is no longer a young man. All the other apostles had died by this point. And almost all of them. The tradition is that all of them had been martyred. So John is the last one, and he is perhaps the only one that dies of natural causes, probably in his 90s. He's a very, very old man. Tradition holds that he was they tried to martyr John as well by boiling him in oil, and he survived that. And he outlives all of the people that had imprisoned him and exiled him to the island of Patmos. And so he returns to the mainland in Asia Minor, what is Turkey today. And he teaches these young men. And one of them is a guy named Polycarp. And Polycarp has a student named Irenaeus. And all these people, actually, there's this long line of people that John teaches just because he undertakes this with this one young man. And these people are actually giants in the early Christian church. And they write down so many of the things that we now understand in the Council of Nicaea. Pieces of their writings make it into the Apostles' Creed. And all the things that we understand come from what John tells them. And John is the last apostle, the last person alive that sat at the feet of Jesus to hear him speak and explain these things. Six times in the New Testament, it says that John was the apostle that Jesus loved. He says that six times. And there's one other thing I need to tell you about John. This is in Luke 9, 51 and 56. And they're traveling towards Jerusalem. And this says something about the character of John, right? And for those of you who have had the experience of raising teenagers, especially teenage boys, you will immediately understand this. And to all the young men, many of you, young and old, right? We will remember being at this stage in our lives. All right. And it was in the fulfilling of the days of taking up him, he had set his face to go to Jerusalem and sent messengers before him. And going, they went into a village of Samaritans so as to prepare for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was set to go to Jerusalem. And seeing his disciples, James and John said, "Lord, do you desire that we tell fire to come down from heaven to destroy them, as also Elijah did?" And I can imagine Jesus shaking his head. But turning, he rebuked them and said, "Do you not know what your spirit is? For the Son of Man did not come to destroy the souls of men, but to save." And they went to another village. Okay? So you can imagine these brash young teenagers, you know, perhaps an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old, you know, running back and saying, "Master, do you want us to call down fire and brimstone?" So this is the John that becomes the John of love that writes the gospel. Many, many, many years later, he's in his 90s. And I imagine that he's sitting, arthritic, old. Everybody has to do everything for him. for him to travel is very, very difficult. He's unable to walk very well at all. And so there are all these young men, scribes, and he's telling them what it was to sit at the feet of Jesus, and they're all writing this down on rolls of papyrus. The oldest piece of New Testament literature that we have is a piece of papyrus. It's been carbon dated to 125 AD, plus or minus 18 years. The way carbon dating works, when the plant is alive, it's absorbing carbon from the atmosphere. And there's two isotopes of carbon. And the two isotopes are getting absorbed by the plant material and become the carbon that's building up the material of the plant. And this is absorbed out of the atmosphere. And we know what that ratio is. But as soon as it gets absorbed into the plant and the plant dies, it stops absorbing that carbon. And that ratio, because one of them is radioactive and decays, it becomes the other one. And so the ratio between the two changes. And the radioactive one decays with time. And we can tell how old this piece of this papyrus that we've dated is. 125 AD. We think John dies around 100 AD. It's possible that the scribe that wrote this particular piece, and by the way, this piece exists, it's in a museum in Manchester in England. I mean, you're all familiar with the British and their crazy whole thing with Egypt, right? They made a whole hilarious series of movies, The Mummy, about this, about the crazy Brits going to Egypt and buying everything that they possibly can and dragging it back to England. Well, that's exactly how this piece of papyrus ends up in Manchester, England. They bought this stack of old papyrus at a flea market in Cairo, and it was in 1930. And many years later, 1934, they're going through this stack, and one of them stumbles into this piece, and he's reading it, and it's in Greek, and he's reading it, and he goes, I know this passage. This passage is out of John 18. The piece of papyrus is called P52, and it's in Manchester, England. I would love to go see this thing. It's encased in, they take care of it like the Declaration, like we take care of the Declaration of Independence, right? It's actually worth a lot more than the Declaration of Independence to me. But this piece of papyrus, 125 AD. So I want to read to you the opening of John. Let's go through, open up to John 1. And now I'm going to be really mean to you. So John 1:1, the very first verse. In Greek it reads, En arche an o logos, kai o logos un pros ton theon, kai theos en o logos. He keeps using this word logo over and over. What's a logo? Say it. What's a logo? Yeah. It's kind of the emblem of a company. Or Ben, what's a logo?
A logo is a series of words or a symbol to represent as an emblem.
Well, it turns out this word has that same meaning, okay? Except more. We translate that word as word. We use words to represent something, right? Words represent something. Tom, okay? Now, when I say Tom, everybody immediately thinks of this person right here, right? Or I say Ilona, right? Or Mike. Or Bill, right? You all get this immediately. You don't think of the word. You don't have to translate that into something in order for it to mean something. You think of that person. Right? That's the word, Bill. You think of that person. That's the way a logo works. You don't think of Apple, right? You think of the company. Or if you're really sick like me, you're thinking Red Delicious or... Anyway. Okay. But it's more than that. This is also the word that we get our word logic from, where there's an order, there's a structure, there's a meaning. All right? And when you start putting this, all these pieces together, and when John says NRK, that's in the beginning, RK, this is the exact word we use for archaeology, the study of beginnings. You'd be surprised how much Greek you already know. This is where the words come from. NRK, in the beginning, NO logos, in the beginning was the word. Okay. So you something in the beginning, at that very instant when everything gets created, was, past tense, the word. The word had already been existing before that. You go, wait, no, in the beginning, right? I want you to imagine this illiterate fisherman coming up with this. And he's a very, very old man. And he's dictating this to his scribes, and they're writing it down. He says, in the beginning was the word. And the implication there is pretty incredibly clear, that this word existed before the beginning. All right. Kai o logos on pros ton theon. Kai and o logos, the word, was pros ton theon, was with, you would literally say the, but we drop that out in English. And the word was with God. Now, there's a funny thing that happens in ancient literature. And actually, if you go back to the Psalms, the Proverbs, you're going to run into this over and over and over again. And it wasn't just the Jews that did this. If you go read the Odyssey and the Iliad, you're going to run into it again. And everything happens in threes. And in ancient literature, for something to be truly captivating, it had to be three things. It had to be true. If it's true, then you can't dispute it. The second thing, it has to be beautiful. And the third thing, it has to be good. Okay? Without doubt, this entire book is true, it is beautiful, and it is good. This falls into that category. Well, so you run into this idea of a triad existing again, over and over and over again. And so you have this. And there's one other thing that happens, and I've run into this in Homer, and I've run into this in here. When you read the original language, it happens in threes, but you also get an idea, and it begins at the first beginning of the first line, it's at the end of the second line, and it's the beginning of the third line. And that happens over and over and over again. One of my favorite verses out of Isaiah 40:31. Right? They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and they shall not faint. Right? Three things. Always three things. Over and over and over again. So here we have, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And because of the way Greek is laid out, it says, en theos en o logos, and God was the Word. So you have, in the beginning was the Word, the Word was with God, and God was the Word. In English, we reverse that, and we say, and the Word was God. John goes on. This one was in the beginning with God. All things through him came into being. By the way, the word that gets used there is agento. And that G-E-N, that's the word we use for Genesis, all the way back to the beginning. And without him came into being not one thing that came into being. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overtake it. So you have this word. This word was with God. The word was God. Then this word was in the beginning, and everything that came into being was because of this word. And nothing came into being without going through this word. This word was life. By the way, the Greek word for life is zoe, right? Zoology, the study of things that live. Light. What's the first verb in photography? P-H-O, pho. Phos is light in Greek. Like I said, you guys could read this. You don't realize it, but you really could. Okay? And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overtake it. And then John makes this little tangent, and he says, there was a man having been sent from God. His name was John. This one came as a witness, that he might witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but that he might witness about the light. This one was the true light, which enlightens every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world through him became, and the world did not know him. And the world did not receive him. But as many as received him, he gave to them the authority to become children of God, to those believing in his name, who not through blood, but nor through the will of the flesh, nor through the will of man, but the will of God were born. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled and lived among us. And we beheld the glory of him, the glory of the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and of truth. John witnesses concerning him and has cried out, saying, this is the one of whom I said, after me comes one preceding me he was, and out of the fullness of him we all received grace on grace. Because through Moses was given the law, grace and truth through Jesus Christ came into being. No one has seen God at any time, only the only begotten Son. And that one explains the Father. This is the opening of John. This is how John explains who Jesus was. Jesus was the Word. Jesus was the light. Jesus was the one that makes it possible for us to go to the Father. To me, this is one of the most amazing things, this opening passage of John. And for an illiterate fisherman to come up with this idea is very, very difficult for me to grasp, unless God is involved. And God is telling John, this is my message. Write this one down. And I have this vision of this old man in the darkness, in this crowd of young men, teenage boys, all writing this stuff down. as this old man is telling them what it was to walk through Judea with Jesus.